The theme of this conference, taking stock of transitional justice, has prompted me to take stock of transitional justice in South Africa. It was exactly 20 years ago, in 1989, when the first group of political prisoners were released from the prisons in South Africa. So if you take a wider definition of transitional justice, we can say that for the past 20 years, transitional justice has been unfolding in South Africa. And I guess this is a right moment to reflect and ask, what has transitional justice achieved in South Africa? And has the project of transitional justice been successful in South Africa? But before I get to the main part of my presentation, by way of background, I'm going to briefly give an overview of what the transitional justice process has achieved in South Africa. And I'm going to be over simplifying things here, being a bit crude because of time. I'll just gloss over what has been achieved with transitional justice. The first one is that over the past 20 years, we've seen the elite compromise being consolidated in South Africa. And in South Africa, this has meant two things. It has meant, on the one hand, the cessation of hostilities between the liberation movement and the apartheid government. But secondly, this elite compromise has meant giving amnesty to perpetrators of apartheid atrocities. The second thing that transitional justice has achieved in South Africa has been the successful transfer, not transformation, but transfer of power from a racist white regime to a political party that has been elected by the majority. The third thing that I would like to highlight is the fact that formal apartheid has been abolished and the inauguration of liberal democracy, underwritten by what is called the best constitution in the world, has been concluded. On the other hand, for victims of apartheid and colonialism, the transitional justice process in South Africa has been a very painful process. 20 years later, victims of apartheid still experience feelings of being betrayed, of being pushed further into the margins of society. 20 years later, victims continue to bear the scars of apartheid in the form of physical and psychological harm, dilapidated homes, and a lot of unanswered questions regarding what happened to their loved ones and the inability to rebuild their lives. Indeed, as many have recorded, all the fundamental promises that were made to victims, the moral and political contracts that underpinned the transitional justice system in South Africa, have been broken. So perpetrators of human rights abuses came to the TRC, you know, told some half-truths, got amnesty, and returned to life of luxury. In the meantime, local and transnational big business, as well as white South Africans who benefited from apartheid, big business that profiteered from apartheid, continued to hold on to the ill-gotten gains of apartheid, while overwhelmingly shunning the transitional justice process. As you know, all this happens against a backdrop where no effective and adequate reparation scheme has been implemented, where not only have those who committed apartheid-related atrocities and did not receive amnesty not been pursued through a vigorous, what the TRC call a vigorous prosecution policy, but as Hugo is going to report just now, the government has consistently taken measures up to today to give amnesty, backdoor amnesty, a second bite of the cherry, as it were, to perpetrators, and also to, you know, seek to give them presidential pardons. With no proper reparation scheme meant to acknowledge victims' pain and contribution, designed to ensure that there is some form of restitution and redress which would help victims restart their lives and be able to participate as full citizens in democracy, victims have been instead being pushed further into the margins of society, their pain and loss unacknowledged, and their feelings of disempowerment entrenched further. The self-imposed structural adjustment program, the microeconomic policy that was imposed or that was adopted in South Africa in 1996, based as it is on fiscal austerity,
poor business policies, cost recovery programs for basic commodities has also affected victims severely, making them even more destitute. To sum up this background then, if the aim of transitional justice global agenda is to show that it is possible for countries in the South coming out of conflict and atrocities to be assisted to transform into something not quite but somehow akin to Western liberal democracy with a good constitution, a couple of state institutions meant to support democracy, peaceful and regular elections, neoliberal economic policies, and what is often referred to as a rule of law and good governance, then South Africa has done well. South Africa is a modern transitional justice baby. However, if we take as we take stock of transitional justice in South Africa, we must recount the story of betrayal committed by the liberation movement. If transitional justice is about assisting victims to rebuild their lives, to regain trust and confidence in themselves and others, if one of the fundamental objectives of transitional justice is to enable victims to reclaim their agency and to become active citizens, then the transitional justice policy in South Africa has failed. Therefore, whether it is from the failure to include victims in all phases of transitional justice, their continuing marginalization during the post-TRC process, the neoliberal microeconomic policies that have led to the commodification of basic commodities such as water, I mean amenities such as water and electricity, the story of transitional justice in South Africa is that of systematic disempowerment of victims. The fact that the transitional justice policy in South Africa has not been victim-centered and has instead been a story of state-driven disempowerment has been well recorded by others and chronicled in the literature. What I would like to focus on today is the lesser told story, and that is how other elites besides state and quasi-state officials have contributed to a disempowerment of victims. What I propose to do here, as we are taking stock of transitional justice and reflecting on the norms and practices of transitional justice, is to turn the spotlight on ourselves as TJ scholars and practitioners, and to ask, to what extent have we, as local and international experts of transitional justice, been complicit in the disempowerment of victims? This afternoon, I want to look at how local and international NGOs, as well as local and international researchers, have played a role, inadvertently, in the disempowerment of victims. I will look at this from the perspective of Kulumani. The two questions that serve as a framework to my discussion are the following. Firstly, who owns and controls transitional justice? Not only in South Africa, but in the whole South today. Secondly, I would like to recast Spivak's question and ask, can the victim speak? And if she speaks, can we hear the victim? But before I do that, let me briefly introduce Kulumani. I'll just be brief about this. So Kulumani, as has been said, was formed in 1995. Today we've got about 55,000 members nationally. The way people affiliate to Kulumani, victims affiliate to Kulumani, is by filling in needs assessment forms where they declare themselves that they are victims and this is what happened to them, and also record what kind of needs they still want. So it's not like the TRC, which was a state authorized, you know, of a designation of victims. In the case of Kulumani, it's people themselves, you know, saying I'm a victim. And also we try to avoid the very legalistic definition of victimhood. By way of structure, as I said, Kulumani has got membership throughout the country. The highest decision-making body in Kulumani is the National Steering Committee, which is made up of people from different provinces who have been elected by different branches. The aim of the organization is to contribute to the transformation of victims from victims to survivors, but ultimately to active citizens. Our key mobilization tool is our Charter for Redress. The Charter for Redress was compiled out of interviews by members from all different provinces. This was 2 years ago, where members said, this is what we demand from the government, this is our ongoing needs. But also in the Charter for Redress, that's where you find the critique of not only the unfinished business of the TRC, but what victims call the rotten foundation of transitional justice in South Africa. So the Charter for Redress is our key mobilization tool. Some of the key programs that we have is the Sustainable Livelihoods Project, where maybe perhaps I should just say the profile of our membership. 75% of our members are unemployed. The majority of our members are women. Majority of our members are people who have been tortured, or you know, their family members have been killed. So there's a lot of abject poverty within the organization. Some of the key programs include the Sustainable Livelihood Project, where we endeavor to make sure that victims are able to make a living for themselves, you know, in the context of no reparations and also in the context of no unemployment. The other program is the Community Reconciliation Project. You know, as you know, in South Africa there was a lot of reconciliation amongst political elites, but there was never social reconciliation between ordinary South Africans. So the Community Reconciliation Project seeks to achieve exactly that. The idea is, how do we reconcile ordinary South Africans, particularly in the black communities, where there was a lot of so-called black-on-black violence, and which, you know, not many people have looked at. The other project is a Lost History Project, or History from Below Project, where victims themselves record what happened to themselves and tell their own stories. The idea here is to challenge the meta-narrative history of the ANC just being the Liberation Party. Therefore, the aim is to try to show, you know, how ordinary people contributed to the struggle. And of course, you know, the other program is advocacy around reparations and around the issues of redress. 90% of our members did not take part in the TRC, therefore they would never have the chance to appear before the TRC. And of course, you know about the case in New York, where, you know, a number of multinational companies have been sued. Over the course of the past 15 years, Khulumani has interacted with hundreds and hundreds of transitional justice NGO workers, consultants, researchers, entrepreneurs, and this is a story that I want to share today, the interaction between Khulumani and transitional justice experts. Let's start with NGOs. In any post-conflict society, NGOs are very critical in ensuring, in taking up important tasks that the government is either unable or unwilling to perform. From helping displaced children link up with their parents, you know, reconstructive surgery for victims of violence of a sexual nature, and a lot of other humanitarian programs. So there's no doubt that NGOs are important. As we reflect on the practice of transitional justice and the call for a more victim-centered transitional justice, we must, however, ask, to what extent have NGOs contributed to the empowerment, the true empowerment of victims? The debates around the nation purpose of NGOs are well known, namely that most NGOs are made up of middle-class professionals who are more accountable to donors than the communities they serve, that NGOs operate in a statist manner, that is, despite the drive-by reference to community participation, most NGOs operate in a top-down mode, that human rights NGOs particularly contribute to the notion of passive citizenship by depoliticizing issues and technicizing politics, thereby sending the message that victims cannot wage the struggle by themselves, but they need and must depend on experts in the form of state officials, lawyers and judges, and of course, NGO workers themselves. This is related to the story of Trusteeship, a project aimed at rescuing people of the South from the savage state. Makomu too has got a nice metaphor for this state, savage victim savior metaphor, where he tries to look at this. David Kennedy puts it as follows, and I quote, "The production of authentic victims of victim authenticity is an inherently voyeuristic and pornographic practice that no matter how carefully or sensitively it's done, transforms the position of the victim in his or her society and produces a language of victimization for him and for her to speak on the international stage." Kennedy goes on to say, "The remove between the human rights professionals and people they purport to represent can reinforce the global divide of wealth, mobility, information, and access to audience. Human rights professionals consequently struggle, ultimately in vain, against a tide of bad faith, orientalism, and self-serving sentimentalism." I think Alain Badiou put it even more nicely, and he says, and I quote, "On the side of victims, the haggard animal exposed on the television screen, on the side of the benefactors, conscious and imperative to intervene. And why does this preaching always assign the same roles to the same side? Who can see that this ethics which rests on the misery of the world has behind its victim, man, the good man, the white man?" End of quote. Despite this, I would like to reemphasize, and this is not a mere concession, that a lot of NGOs do good, and some do not even possess this savior mentality, but you know, just want to help. Still, a lot of others contribute to the disempowerment of victims in very profound ways. At Kulumani, unfortunately, we have encountered this many times, and I will just highlight in bullet point four. So every month or so, we get contacted by NGOs, both local and international, wanting Kulumani to organize a specific number of victims who will benefit from some or other intervention, which in the expert opinion of the NGO is very critical and victims can't do without. Implicit in such requests is the idea that for the past 14 years, Kulumani as an organization has not done anything to help its members. And as a victims organization, we deserve their charity and all solidarity, and that victims lack any agency to co-design, co-plan, and co-implement any programs. In Africa, there's about three or four NGOs which, because of their resources and influence, dominate the transitional justice industry. Too many times, Kulumani has been invited to attend and benefits from workshops, seminars, roundtables, discussions organized by these NGOs to sensitize victims and to share international best practices. In these meetings, it is clear where the power lies. The imparting of knowledge and skill is one way, from NGO experts to victims. We've also noticed how obsessed other NGOs are with documentation. Bunchy seminar packages, slazy PowerPoints, and of course, the glossy reports. Now look, there's nothing wrong with documentation if it's meant to be part of reflection and empowerment. But for many NGOs that we've encountered, the obsession with documentation, they're obsessed with documentation because that's how they ultimately legitimize their expertise, the fact that they are a knowledge bank. All of this documentation are therefore ultimately meant for donors and not for victims. Indeed, we must ask again, who controls and owns transitional justice? And whether transitional justice NGOs really are interested in the true empowerment of victims? And then finally, let me quickly turn my attention to transitional justice scholars and researchers. Over the years, we have been contacted by researchers wanting to learn about victims, to conduct in-depth interviews with victims, and to find out victims' views on a number of issues. Researchers who conduct Kulumani are well-meaning people, concerned about the ongoing plight of victims, outraged by the lack of government support, and wanting to name and shame the government, and really just wanted to help. There are literally hundreds of well-written, convincing, and groundbreaking articles, monographs, and other publications on South African transitional justice process. There are therefore a couple of scholars who deservedly, it must be said, have become experts on various aspects of South African transitional justice. As we've asked with NGO workers, we must also ask with researchers and scholars, to what extent have they contributed to the general empowerment of victims? To what extent have their representation of victims in a situation allowed victims to speak? In the interest of time, I'll just highlight certain things that have concerned me. Every time I receive application proposal from somebody to do research in Kulumani, the first that I always read is a literature review from the researcher. And one thing that always fascinates me is the absence of African scholars in the work consulted by the researchers. It is as if African scholars do not have a voice when it comes to transitional justice. Again, we must ask who controls and owns the transitional justice agenda. The other issue that we need to explore is what have all these tons and tons of brilliant researchers, transitional justice in South Africa, been useful. To come back to Kulumani, over the last couple of years, it has only happened twice that researchers have shared their findings with us. Overwhelmingly, researchers will conduct Kulumani months before they do the interview. They will come to the organization, interview me, our director of victims, and after that, you know, they fly away, and that's the last time we hear from them. And of course, this research, you know, goes towards the professional advancement of these researchers. As many developmental studies have researchers have pointed out, this is a new form of imperialism, the mining and gathering of resources from the south to be used in the north. I'm out of time, so I'll just wrap up. The aim of this presentation is, of course, not to vilify NGO workers and researchers. It's not to say that all of them are imperialists and solely motivated by the need to legitimize themselves and grab donor funds and keep the research still going. The aim, however, is to invite the conversation about what do we truly mean when we talk about a victim-centered transitional justice, and whether despite the rhetorical acknowledgement of the need for transitional justice to be victim-centered and empowering, have we truly translated this into reality? Taking stock of transitional justice and reflecting on what we mean by victim-centered process must also mean that as NGO workers, activists, consultants, and practitioners, we must take this opportunity to reflect on the manner in which we operate and further disempower victims and rob them of any sense of agency and active citizenship. Thank you.